I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Nicholas Kristof wrote a column in the New York Times in December, midway through the month, expressing his fears about the reaction to the election of Donald Trump on many university campuses. He wrote, and I quote, "I share apprehensions about President-elect Trump, but also fear the reaction was evidence of how insular universities have become. When students inhabit liberal bubbles, they're not learning much about their own country. To be fully educated, students should encounter not only Plato, but also Republicans. I fear that liberal outrage at Trump's presidency will exacerbate the problem of liberal echo chambers by creating a more hostile environment for conservatives and evangelicals." The following day, our guest this hour, Donald Dresner, professor of international politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University and a regular contributor to the Washington Post, wrote, "The 2016 election might not be the best example to use of academic closed-mindedness. If it had produced the standard liberal versus conservative presidential race, I'd understand the cocooning claim. But in contrast to the 2012 or 8 presidential elections, conservative academics were not exactly Trump enthusiasts." So we're going to be talking about what's going on campuses, if universities tend to be predominantly liberal, what the reaction was to the Trump victory. There were accounts of conservative students feeling that they needed safe spaces, liberal students who are crying about the election, and what the role is at the university to embrace all points of view. What happens, though, if some of those viewpoints may be counter to American values? Well, we're going to have a darned interesting conversation this hour, don't you think? And we'll be welcoming your phone calls for Donald Dresner. He is also a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a frequent contributor to the Washington Post. He's the author of 5 books, The System Worked, How the World Stopped After Another Great Depression, and Here's How You Reach Us This Hour, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. And after that lengthy introduction, Daniel, we welcome you. Hi, thanks for being with us.
Hi, nice to be here.
Yeah, nice to have you. So this election, let's start with how unusual this election was, because you talk in your article about the number of conservative intellectuals who had expressed a great deal of alarm about Donald Trump.
Right. The important thing to realize, I don't disagree entirely with what Nick Kristof wrote in that column, and I think it's certainly fair to point out the overwhelming liberal bias in the academy. But that said, this was an unusual election because as much as liberals did not like Donald Trump, conservatives were equally horrified. And indeed, there were petitions, a number of them, from members of the Republican foreign policy community, from various Republican or conservative intellectual outlets, various pundits, you know, ranging from David Brooks to George Will to Charles Krauthammer to Mark Gershon, all of whom flatly opposed Donald Trump as the GOP nominee and as the to be president. So this was not a normal election in the sense of a sort of traditional left-right split or liberal-conservative split. This clearly was a kind of confounding election. But the primary cleavage by which a lot of people voted or a lot of people expressed their preference was, in fact, the degree of higher education they had. Generally speaking, the more and the better educated someone was, the less likely that person was to support Donald Trump. So it's not surprising that university students were surprised, not just because a lot of them are overwhelmingly liberal, but because even the traditional conservative sources that they might have looked at if they were a thoughtful conservative, they would have run into mostly criticism of Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm. Daniel, tell me what the reaction was at Tufts University the day after the election.
Well, the reaction, so I teach at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, which is a graduate school for international affairs, and it would be safe to say that the reaction the day after was like going to a funeral. Mm. There were people who were genuinely emotionally distraught. There were people crying in the Hall of Flags. There was an overall somber feel to the place. These were a community of students that were genuinely crushed about the vote. I would suggest, however, and this is important, that one of the reasons that the reaction at Fletcher was particularly acute is that approximately half of our students come from overseas. It's a School of International Affairs. It's a very prestigious School of International Affairs. We attract an awful lot of students who come from the Middle East and come from Latin America and so forth. And I think they were genuinely concerned that a presidential candidate who had run on a platform essentially bashing Muslims to a fair amount and immigrants from Latin America to another extent, they were concerned that this person was actually now going to be the president and what that meant for their own immigration status. Mm-hmm. Likelihood.
Did you know any students who were very conservative who felt that they were unable to express their joy at, not all conservatives would have expressed joy at the election, but those who were Trump supporters, did they feel that they couldn't express that, do you think, on the campus?
I don't doubt that that was probably the case. I know a few students, I knew a few right-leaning students. I teach another large contingent of Fletcher students are people who come from the military, and that group as a general cadre tend to be more conservative than the overall Fletcher student body. The students who were conservative there, I would say some of them were upfront about it. Others generally kept their head down. You know, the joke in a lot of the post-election writing on this is that being a conservative in the academy is the equivalent to, you know, being gay and in the closet. And I think there is some element of truth to that. And this is, again, where it's something where I think Christoph gets at it. Although, again, Fletcher is unusual because as a School of International Affairs, I think it's safe to say there wasn't that much support, if any, frankly, for Trump's kind of foreign policy worldview.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that there was more than a small element of people stereotyping in the academic world, stereotyping Trump voters as bigots, as racists?
This is where things get complex. I won't deny that I think that probably happened. And I think it certainly could be the case that there were. Part of the question is where it happened. Did it happen inside a classroom? Does it happen at another function? Is it a sort of random one-off sentence said by an English professor as a statement, or is it actually a more substantive part of the class curriculum? I was teaching global political economy this fall, and I actually had a session at the very end that I'd planned in advance on the rise of populism, not just in the United States, but in Europe as well. And I assigned literature suggesting that the primary source of this populism was not necessarily economic anxiety, as has often been articulated in the public debate, but rather a genuine cultural backlash about waves of immigration or refugees coming into Europe or the United States. I think you can talk about that in a relatively sophisticated way without necessarily saying that all Trump voters are therefore racist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Christoph made the point in his piece, and I'm wondering if you will bear this out, that studies have shown, repeated studies, he says, that about 10% of professors in the social sciences or the humanities are Republicans. Is that, do you think, generally true, and is that problematic?
I will say yes to both. This is where I don't disagree at all with Nick Christoph. The evidence here is that the overwhelming body of academics at universities, particularly elite universities, tend to lean to the left, Democrat or even further left than that. And furthermore, the data shows that actually this has gotten more concentrated over the last 20 years. That if you go back 30, 40, or 50 years, there was more of a political heterogeneity among the academy. Over the last 20 years or so, however, it has tilted further leftward. Now, the question then is, what does this mean? I would argue that professors are literally part of a profession. And there are certain professional codes and standards that mean that even if the members of that group lean one way or the other politically, it doesn't mean they don't necessarily do their jobs badly. Just as the military tends to, the officer corps in the military tends to lean much more in a conservative direction, but no one questions whether they're doing their job well or not, I think the same can be true of the academy. That said, I do think there's growing evidence that ideological homogeneity within the academy doesn't necessarily affect the quality of the research that's being done right now, but it can affect what people decide they want to research. the kinds of questions they want to bring up. Because generally, and this is not shocking, people do not necessarily want to research questions that might, if they get a result that, they don't necessarily want to research a topic if the conclusion they reach contradicts their core political beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a result, you do, to some extent, want some degree of political heterogeneity, I think, within the academy in order to be able to sponsor a thriving marketplace of ideas.
Mm. And what about for the students? If you only have 10% of professors identifying as Republican, do you get a lack of intellectual thought? Are you, if you're not getting a conservative viewpoint, are you an educated person?
I think that you definitely want to get a conservative viewpoint, but I also don't think that you have to be a conservative to successfully articulate a conservative viewpoint. Anyone who's a professor, who at least is a reasonably good professor, should be very well trained in being a devil's advocate in the classroom, which is to say, if I'm running a seminar and I have all of my students leaning up instinctively in one direction, as a professor, my job is to then go and tack in the opposite direction and really challenge their core beliefs. And indeed, I don't think if you've gone to a high place of higher education and your core beliefs haven't been challenged, then I don't think you've necessarily gotten a proper education. Now, the question is whether someone espousing a conservative viewpoint effectively has to be conservative. And there I would actually disagree. I think someone who's reasonably well-educated, well-read in conservative political thought should be able to articulate what a conservative political position is relatively effectively to a group of 18-year-olds or 19-year-olds. So in this sense, no, I don't think that you have to be conservative to ensure that you have an ideologically vibrant a vibrant classroom. What you do have to do, however, ideally, is to sort of keep your own political predilections from infecting what you say to your students.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least, you know, because at that point, you have a student who might feel conservative and might be somewhat reluctant to articulate that view precisely because they do fear what the implications would be for their grades.
Let's talk about the effect this is having on campuses around the country. I'm sure that I'm concentrating on a Milwaukee case that happened recently, and tell me if you see more of this and if it will be problematic. This is a speaker who was permanently banned from Twitter for inciting or engaging in the targeted abuse or harassment of others. He was invited to speak at UW-Milwaukee in December. He's from Breitbart. It's his dangerous faggot tour, he calls himself, and he came to the student union, and he singled out and showed a picture of a transgender student and called this person out by name during his speech to the crowd, which had quite a few people there. And the student later withdrew from school. I'm wondering about this kind of rhetoric that all of a sudden, you know, we're not used to hearing people from Breitbart. We're not used to white national movements. We're not used to these people being invited to be speakers on campuses because the nature of what they're saying. And one could say, probably justifiably, there's some hatred involved here, which is not good for free speech, or it kind of goes beyond free speech, or does it? Do you see more of this kind of thing happening on campuses, and how should it be handled?
I think without question you're seeing more of it happening on campuses, in part because the strategies of people like the Breitbart columnist that you're talking about, I believe his first name is Milo,
yes,
part of the so-called alt-right, one of their tactics is in fact to provoke outrage from people who disagree with them. And if you are trying to troll people into being into getting outraged, then you actually have to adopt outrageous positions, which is certainly what it sounds like Milo did in Milwaukee, and it was consistent with what he does elsewhere when he's gone on speaking tours. So I think the proper question to ask at this point is, first of all, what group is inviting the speaker in the first place? Does that actually necessarily add to the marketplace of ideas? I think you can bring someone who's an economic populist or even a cultural populist and try to get those points of view onto campus. I think that's certainly a valuable thing to do without necessarily inviting someone whose sole purpose appears to be to inflame those who disagree with them. So partly you have to choose better speakers on that point. I think that's one of the ways in which I would respond to it.
And what about for, you mentioned your international students and Tufts, your school, having a number of students from abroad. I'm wondering if their fears of being called out, deporting Muslims that Donald Trump talked about, and certainly what's happening with people who are here illegally from Mexico, I'm wondering if a lot of students in those targeted kinds of groups by a person who's a president-elect feel very vulnerable right now? Do they feel that they're safe at school? Do they feel they're safe being here? How do they feel?
I think a lot of them feel scared. There's no questioning that. We had a sort of open session after Trump's victory, in which we talked a little bit about what the policies we'll expect to see coming down the pike, and we talked about immigration. It was clear that the students were very concerned about what would happen if the INS suddenly decided, or if the federal government decided that they were going to be more restrictive in terms of immigration policies. And I think the larger issue in terms of fear has to do with the fact that essentially they saw a candidate who, as I said, campaigned on, in some ways, the most explicitly sort of racially and or religiously tinged campaign that we've seen in at least 30, 40 years, and then that person got elected. So as a result, rather than, I think, what I think a lot of people, at least a lot of students hoped was, is that if Trump lost, that would represent a repudiation of that kind of campaign tactic. By winning, it seems that not only is it an affirmation of it, but it also sends a signal to people who might have already held those kinds of views about either Muslims or Mexicans or what have you, that they can now be more public in such views. And indeed, you've seen a variety of these kinds of videos spiraling across social media.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour is Daniel Dresner. He's a professor of international politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, and wrote a piece in the Washington Post that appeared in December that we will put on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Has Donald Trump exposed the liberal academic cocoon? And he's taken a look at liberal universities, and also has responded to a column that was written the day before that was critical of the universities not accepting more conservative thought or hiring more people who are conservative on campuses. That one written by Nicholas Kristof. Well, here's our number. I think our phones are going to be humming from now on, so grab one of our lines right now while it's open, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Do write your comments there. We like to read them when we're off the air, or when we're on the air, too, for that matter, and Twitter, @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network. And now we go to phone calls. Nate is our first caller in La Crosse. Hi, Nate.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call. I just had a comment. I did my undergraduate work at UW-Eau Claire, and one of my economics professors was one of the leadership of the, and he definitely was the best person at espousing a conservative point of view based on economics, but stimulating discussion. So I just wanted to throw that out there and say that's definitely my experience here in Wisconsin.
And did you find that many of your professors were conservative? Do you think there was a balance in the education? Was it important that there be a balance with a political philosophy or not, Nate?
I think that on the whole, professors are liberal, and you can tell that, but I think you can also tell that they don't necessarily use their personal beliefs when they're teaching. They definitely value the discussion and making both sides of the arguments.
Mm-hmm. I would say one of the complicating factors and one of the ways in which this is more difficult now than it was even a decade ago is that even a decade ago, I'm not sure that a lot of students, unless they made a concerted effort, would necessarily know what the political views of their professors were. One of the issues we have to deal with now is we have social media. And so it is easier for a student, if they're interested in a professor, to essentially Google them, check out if they're on Twitter or if they've written for a blog or what have you, and get a sense of what their views are. And it becomes that much more difficult for a professor to maintain or to preserve what might be their own personal political views, which they are certainly entitled, and indeed it would be a good thing for them to express them, but, you know, trying to keep that separate from what you say in the classroom.
Do you share the opinion that suddenly was all over the place after the surprise election of Donald Trump, that people were saying, oh, media was saying, political pundits were saying, everybody was saying, oh, we just didn't hear all of these people. We just haven't heard a good chunk of the American population, and at last now at least we'll be able to hear what their concerns are. Did we ignore, do you think, a huge part of the population? Are universities to blame for any of that? Why did everybody not hear those voices?
Well, I would say a few things. As someone who paid pretty close attention to the 2016 election, I don't think there was a shortage of Trump voter profiles. There were a fair number of them in, you know, what you would consider the elite media, whether it be the New York Times or the Washington Post or the New Yorker or what have you. I don't think that was, and there was a fair amount of attention paid to the rise of populism in the United States as well prior to the 2016 election. So, no, I don't think that. Now, you could potentially argue that some of those profiles were patronizing in the sense of they looked down on whoever they were reporting, but I don't think that's necessarily true of most of the coverage. And not to mention the fact that there were books like, let's say, J.D. Vance's Hillbilly Elegy.
Right.
That also sort of broke through. So I think the idea that only in November did we realize, oh, my God, we've got to pay attention to the sort of typical Trump voter, no, I generally don't think that's true. You could, and furthermore, I would argue that there was university research, and there were a few university press books that came out along with Hillbilly Elegy to take a look at this population as well. What it might be the case is that, you know, generally speaking, a lot of students and or professors, much like a lot of Americans, tend to operate under conditions of what political scientists like to call rational ignorance, which is to say that they don't have an incentive to necessarily pay that much attention to things like politics because it normally doesn't affect their daily lives, even in the case of a presidential election. So I think it's possible that you had a lot of people who were not paying that close attention to the election, but seemed to, you know, if they would click on it once or twice, would notice that, oh, everyone seemed to think that Hillary Clinton was probably going to win, and then got shocked by the outcome.
Thanks very much, Nate, for the call. Matt in Wausau sends this email. I don't think anyone was stating that all Trump supporters were racist bigots. All he needed to win the election was 100,000 or so rural white voters spread across Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, which he obviously did. Republicans gauge success in monetary terms. Their views are expressed in the legislation they put forward, whereas I feel at least the teachers I've met in my life have overwhelmingly cited an interest in helping people learn. They don't seem to gauge their self-worth in financial success.
Well, one explanation that is often made for why the university or why the academy does tilt to the left is because there's not a whole lot of money in it. So if you want to become a professor, in some ways you are usually sacrificing the higher income that normally comes with getting a graduate degree with a combination of presumably living the life of the mind, but also some degree of economic security if you are fortunate enough to be someone who gets tenure. So that's one of the arguments, the common arguments that is made for why the academy tilts left, that it's a self-selection process, that people go into this because they recognize that they want to live a certain kind of lifestyle, which might not necessarily be consistent with those who want to maximize income.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, there's also a lot of feedback effects here, which is if you know that the academy is predominantly leftward at this point, and you're a conservative, then that can be another deterrent effect for you deciding not to, you know, get a PhD.
Christopher in Eau Claire, hi.
Hello.
Hi, Christopher.
Oh, hello. Just for the election, I'm a student up at UW-Eau Claire, and we had Donald Trump come up and speak, and the university stated that we let people of all parties and affiliations speak there, so that's why they let him speak. But there's a huge amount of student backlash, both before he spoke and afterwards, saying that his presence was jeopardizing the safety of all students there. And my question is, how much responsibility should the universities be putting for students of certain backgrounds? Because my views are like, if, you know, you don't want to hear him speak, you shouldn't go to attend the, you know, the rally and such. But, you know, my question is, what should the university do to make sure that all students feel safe and welcome there?
All right, good question, Professor.
Well, I think there's a difference between telling students that there will be a vibrant set of ideas that they're going to confront as opposed to saying that they're going to be safe. The word safe is one of those things where it's a little bit problematic to say Which is you want students to feel like they're actually going to be challenged in terms of their viewpoints. You want them to feel physically safe and secure, of course, and that's something where I think the university obviously, you know, has to say that we tolerate a diverse set of ideas. We don't necessarily tolerate violent action as the solution to those ideas. So presumably one of the ways you do it is by making sure you have a pretty wide array of speakers who come to campus, and if one of those speakers happens to be a presidential candidate, well, so be it. But you have to be very careful with the word safe, because ideas are not always safe. Ideas can be challenging or threatening or potentially existentially questioning. I don't always think that's necessarily a bad thing. I think it's something that you, if you want to be a thinking member of society, you occasionally have to challenge or deal with doubts. And it's how you cope with that and then deal with that afterwards that it allows you to process new ideas.
Mm. How concerned are you about the uptick in hate crimes in society tied to Trump's rise?
I'm pretty concerned, although I want to see whether the data bears this out. I know that there have been reports, obviously, from a few institutions showing that there's been an uptick in these kinds of attacks, and I wouldn't be surprised if that was the case. There have also, however, been a number of instances in which there was a reported crime, and then it turned out that the person who reported it had either made it up and or, you know, it was wildly exaggerated. Being in the Boston area, there was a case where two Babson College students got in a truck and drove through Wellesley College, screaming about the fact that Trump had won, and you know, understandably, the Wellesley students were upset. But the initial reporting on that incident wildly overplayed what the two Babson students did. There's no doubt they acted rudely and insensitively, but the original report, I think, had a lot more hyperbole than what actually wound up happening. I think one of the things we need to do is take a deep breath and see what the data looks like a year from now.
Mm-hmm. And I remember, just a side note here, I remember I was out of town somewhere when Trump was speaking at the University of Eau Claire, and I was thinking as I was watching the coverage, why is he speaking at the University of Eau Claire? Because that area tends to be a Democratic part of the state. And if I had thought about it more and done more research, a lot of people could have figured out what was going on in Wisconsin, because that area became Trump area. It was pretty remarkable. He knew what he was doing going to the University of Eau Claire, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let's go next to Bill in Middleton. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. From Palmer, July 26, 2016, in the Daily News Bin, wrote a beautiful article. New evidence reveals Donald Trump is a financial and political puppet of Vladimir Putin's Russia. He bothers me. I have been to Russia, to Estonia, Finland. I know your college talks about foreign affairs and foreign countries. I could have been a full professor, you know, but instead of living in an ivory tower, no affront to you, I went there to find out what happened to my tribe.
Okay, thanks, Bill, very much for your call. Let's go to Jim in Rice Lake. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Kathleen. I'm enjoying your guest. I just wanted to say, well, I understand your speaker's comments. I mean, with the definite exception probably of the business school, it's no surprise that the academy and the university are primarily Democrats. I think it was David Brooks who said that the Democratic Party is the postgraduate party, meaning if you're running around with a JD or a PhD, you're probably a liberal. But I think what I'd like to hear a response from your guests is the point. The one understated thing, other than the shock of Trump's victory, is how underwhelming or how vastly inherently flawed Hillary Clinton was as a candidate. We know about Trump's xenophobic comments and attitudes, but it was Clinton's xenophobic lifestyle with her private server and her cloistered foundation that I think struck a fundamental discord amongst the American people. I'll be interested in hearing your guest's comments off here. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much, Professor Dresner.
Sure. Well, I'd say a few things. First of all, again, as flawed as a candidate as Hillary Clinton was, it is worth remembering she got 2.8 million more votes than Donald Trump in the election, even though she obviously lost the Electoral College. The second thing is that as much as people talk about Clinton's xenophobic foundation, I'm not entirely sure what that means, it's not like Trump's charitable works were necessarily any better. And indeed, if you want to talk about corruption, I fear that Donald Trump as president is about to make whatever Hillary Clinton was accused of doing seem like a pittance compared to the potential opportunities for corruption, given who Trump and his appointees are about to place in the administration. But that all said, it is true that Hillary Clinton was an extremely flawed candidate, and Donald Trump had clearly tapped into, you know, some kind of resentments, particularly in places like Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania. So there is no denying that, you know, Donald Trump winning is in no small part because Hillary Clinton lost at least the Electoral College. So I would certainly concede that point. And she was not a perfect candidate. On the other hand, there are very few perfect candidates in presidential politics. Someone only seems perfect when they win, or someone only seems better when they win. And the other thing I would add, and this is striking, there was data that came out by the Gallup polling earlier this week that shows, in contrast to the previous three presidents, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama, all of whom were in many ways polarizing presidents, the support for them among the population at this time, which is normally the sort of peak, normally when a president is about to be inaugurated, there is at least some groundswell in popular support for that person in terms of their ability to do the job. Donald Trump, in comparison, has something like only 40 or 50, you know, under 50% support on a variety of tasks, such as handling a foreign affairs crisis or rooting out corruption in the United in the federal government, whereas these other three presidents averaged over 70%. So, again, no denying that Hillary Clinton was a very flawed presidential candidate. I am, unfortunately, also very worried about Donald Trump being an extremely flawed president.
Hmm. What is his relationship? I'm thinking about other presidents. The people he's surrounding him with tend to be people who have done very, very well in business, military people. There is a lack of sort of reaching out to universities. Most of them recently have, unfortunately, been from just East Coast Ivy League schools, whereas FDR had people from, you know, all over the country. But I'm wondering what the relationship with the academy will be with Donald Trump. Will he heed the advice of liberal and conservative professors at universities all over the country? Has he established relationships? Are there anybody who's advising him who really knows history in one subject or another?
No.
No.
It's a very simple answer. I mean, you know, there is no denying that, Donald Trump likes to brag about the fact that he went to Wharton, for example, that he got a very fine education. But it is very clear, and this is, again, you know, consistent with what he has articulated for not just this election, but for the past 30 or 40 years, that he doesn't place a lot of stock in people who are considered academic successes. He generally is concerned with, he respects what he would, you know, we would consider men of action, and it's mostly men. Which for him means either corporate titans or military leaders. And to be fair, there are certain qualities that those people will bring to the administration that might actually cause them to shake things up. It remains to be seen. But on the other hand, as a group, this might be the cabinet that has the least experience in the federal government prior to being sworn in that we'll have seen in quite some time.
Thanks for your call, Jim. Chris in Wisconsin Dells. Hi.
Hi. I have a couple things to say. The first is that I've been chilling with the University of Wisconsin in a not-so-pleasant way for the past 30 years.
All right, get to what we're talking about, though.
I know. I'm going to get to it. The university is not the university is not the university. Right now, the University of Wisconsin system has practically all the Board of Regents are Scott Walker appointees. You can't judge a university by its professors exclusively. A lot of the administrators are very conservative. And the other thing I wanted to say is that I was a film studies minor. I took a class from a professor on the House Un-American Activities Committee and all the people that were blacklisted. And I also took a class from Lucy and Desi. And the reason for that is that Lucille Ball was responsible for moving all of television and film out to Los Angeles for the most part. And if you don't understand the history of the country, which is rooted in cultural thought as much as it's rooted in political thought, then you don't get a grip on where we came from and where we're going.
Thank you, Chris. What about administrators? Are many of them conservative? Does that make a difference on campuses?
Well, administrators have, you know, without question, exercised an even greater control over the university than they used to. In no small part because universities are now big businesses in a way that they weren't before, due to the increases in things like tuition and employment and so forth. Do they exercise a conservative impulse? I would say it is certainly possible. Certainly at state universities with Republican governors or Republican legislatures, I have no doubt that there is some degree of conservative tilt among administrative appointees. I think within private universities, it's not so much that they're necessarily conservative, although some of them are. It's that they are things like budget conscious, which means they need to worry about how donors view their university. And donors tend to tilt a little bit more to the right.
Thanks, Chris, for your call. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, and our guest this hour is Professor Daniel Dresner. He's a professor of international politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He's also at the Brookings Institution, contributes frequently to the Washington Post, is the author of 5 books, the most recent, The System Worked, How the World Stopped Another Great Depression. And we're talking about a piece that he wrote that appeared in the Washington Post, Has Donald Trump Exposed the Liberal Academic Cocoon? He wrote this a day after a Nick Kristof column in the New York Times about the Academy. So we'll take more phone calls. We have a line open if you want to be with us. That would be good. Our number is 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network. Paul, our next caller in Racine. Hi, Paul.
Hello?
Yeah, Paul, go ahead.
Hi. Real quick question for you. I was wondering what the benefits were of an indirect democracy versus a direct democracy. In my mind, and I am no collegiate laureate at that, but I do not understand what the fact is that if we live in America, which is one person is equal to another person, why there is an issue with one vote versus another vote. And secondly, your whole bunch on the news about Hillary Clinton and how criminal she was, and you seem to never hear anything about Trump University. Thank you. I'll take the comments off the air.
Okay, thanks very much for the call.
With regard to Trump University, I believe that case was actually finally settled after Trump won the election, in no small part because I believe the judge, Judge Curiel, suggested to Trump that he might want to get that case off of his deck before he actually assumed the office of the presidency. So that's probably one of the reasons why it's the way the political cycle works. Once a case is resolved like this, it doesn't necessarily come up. It is worth remembering, however, that Trump essentially taught a scam university and actually had to make a payout as a result of that. With respect to whether we live in a democracy, the answer is we live in a republic. And a republic is almost by definition an indirect democracy. The notion is that you want mediating institutions like, you know, Congress or the presidency or the Supreme Court to act as something of a barrier between the passions of the body politic and actually implementing policy. And I think this is another reason why an awful lot of commentators did not think that Donald Trump was necessarily going to win in November, because he did seem to represent the kind of raw populism that, you know, has taken hold not just in the United States, but across Europe and a lot of the advanced industrialized world. The interesting question now going forward will be what Donald Trump can do as president, given that the GOP controls both houses of Congress, whether he can actually implement everything that he has promised, including things like building a wall in Mexico and renegotiating NAFTA and negotiating better trade deals, eliminating the trade deficit, defeating ISIS. It's a pretty tall list, and we'll see whether he actually succeeds or not.
Thanks for the call. We go to Anna Lee. Hi, Anna Lee.
Hillary Clinton being a flawed candidate, and I was a government worker.
I'm sorry, I missed the whole first part of whatever you were saying. It's like you were cut off in mid-sentence. Go ahead, Anna Lee. Do I have... Okay, Anna Lee, hello?
Hello, yeah.
My fault, I got the wrong line here. Hi, go ahead.
I'm a liberal arts student in St. Olaf, Minnesota, and we have...
I'm sorry, Anna Lee, can you get on another line? Your phone is really bad. The phone is...
I'm sorry. If it's not going to work out, I can just hang up.
I can hear you. No, I can hear you now. Go ahead.
Okay.
Quickly.
I'm sorry. I just wonder why it is that highly educated people are politically liberal. As opposed to most highly educated people being politically conservative, like, what is it about being in school for like 10 years that makes you liberal.
You think that's true, that most highly educated people are liberal, Professor?
Well, not necessarily. It would be that, you know, part of the problem with parsing this out is that, generally speaking, there's a pretty strong correlation between education and income. And generally speaking, the richer people are, the more often they tend to be Republican. Although it is true that to some extent, increasingly, the Democratic Party is the home of educated professionals. What made this election, the 2016 election, particularly unusual, I think, is that by and large, even well-educated and rich voters tended to shift more towards Hillary Clinton and away from Donald Trump. Whereas those people who were particularly wealthy but did not have that much of a college education were more likely to support Trump. So I would be careful in making the general observation that, you know, the better educated you are, the more likely you are to vote Democrat. That has not always been the case, and it might not be, you know, the case going forward. I would argue, and again, this goes back to the original point about why it is that occasionally or that people like Trump did not necessarily find a hospitable environment in higher education, is that presumably the one thing that you do get when you're exposed to higher education is the idea that you have to tolerate, or hopefully you have to tolerate, opposing points of view. And you know, be exposed to people who are potentially different from you. And the extent to which, essentially, Donald Trump ran on a platform that was sort of very exclusionary, mm-hmm. with the notion of, you know, making America great again, somehow going back to this world of the 1950s, there are an awful lot of portions of the U.S. population that would not want to live in what the world looked like in the 1950s to them, because it would have been horrible.
Well, there was also an element which made the whole campaign difficult to watch, of extreme crudeness and making fun of people who were disabled, and the whole groping of women. There was something just very distasteful about all of it.
Yes, there was actually an article in The New Yorker this week that talks actually about conservative intellectuals who did support Trump, people like Mark Bauerlein, who's a professor at Emory. And when you bring up these things even to him, even he sighs and acknowledges that Trump is an imperfect vessel at best for the ideas that they want to articulate. And so that was in some ways the problem. Even the intellectuals who might have appreciated the push towards economic populism, the idea of restoring American greatness, have to deal with the fact that Donald Trump is just a colossal bore, and there's no way of getting around it. He's just a really crude kind of guy.
Anna Lee, thanks very much. Rich in Rhinelander. Hey, Rich.
Hi. Thank you. We're talking about how professors and others get their ideas out there for consideration. And one of my concerns, and I want the professor's reaction to this, is I'd be concerned about any professor who communicated most of his ideas by tweeting. And so I'm really alarmed that the idea of, and I guess I'm getting pretty close to being sarcastic about the man, but that it is a conservative position to tweet what you consider to be significant ideas. It's almost cartoonish. I guess I'll leave it at that.
Thanks, Rich.
Well, as it turns out, my next book, which is coming out in the spring, is called The Ideas Industry, and it actually deals with one of these questions about the extent to which professors, think tank fellows, you name it, try to get their ideas out there. And as someone who actually uses Twitter on a fairly regular basis, yeah, I'm a little worried about Donald Trump's reliance on the tool. But I guess the way I would put it is that there are ways in which social media act as an amplifier rather than the sole source of someone's ideas. I think in Trump's case, it is fair to say that a lot of his policy ideas really can be limited to a single tweet, to 140 characters. And that's in some ways kind of problematic. Although, again, it's worth remembering that most presidents are not necessarily detail guys. The idea is they are trying to articulate a broader ideology, and the hope is that the president's staff and cabinet officials and so on and so forth will fill in the details. And so that's worth pointing out. But professors very often, when they are tweeting or when they are on Facebook or when they are blogging or doing all of these kinds of things, what they are trying to do is talk to a wider public that can't attend their classrooms. As a way of trying to make sure that the ideas that they have researched or the hypotheses that they have developed actually do have an impact in the wider world. And so that, I think, is perfectly commendable.
Hmm. You just wish that there wouldn't be a tweet, you know, concerning how you're going to respond, or just with the possibility of a threat to North Korea about, no, you're not going to get a nuclear weapon. Your mind goes a little bit in a dangerous direction when you think about what might happen, what he means by that. The totality of and the intricacy of how we respond to foreign nations is something that requires more than a tweet, don't you think?
Someone who teaches statecraft, yeah, I'm going to make the argument that, yes, it certainly does require more than a tweet. On the other hand, Donald Trump is in a sort of awkward position at this point. Remember, he's still the president-elect. He's not the president. So he doesn't control the apparatuses of government yet. He doesn't occupy the White House, as it were. So in some ways, the question is, what is he doing to try to make sure that he's still publicly visible? And it seems rather clear that Donald Trump craves public visibility. As it turns out, you do this by Twitter. The interesting question will be, after January 20th, to what extent does he use the POTUS Twitter account, which he will assume once he's inaugurated, as a means of doing, you know, of communicating his message? My hunch is that he will probably continue to use it as sort of a bully pulpit, although I also at least tend to think it might get a little more boring. Because it's one thing for a president-elect to tweet something. It's another thing entirely for a president to tweet something.
Right.
And then furthermore, here's the larger issue is the following, which is, if Trump continues to make sort of belligerent tweets with regard to China or North Korea or so on and so forth, but that actually doesn't translate into any policy action, then you're in a situation where you begin to downgrade or discount whatever Trump says on Twitter. Because he might say a lot of crazy things, but if nothing actually comes to pass, then why should we take him seriously on Twitter anymore?
Terry sends this message on Facebook. Thanks for the show. Two quick points. One, the guest said that campuses are leaning more left in the last 20 years. Could it not also be that conservatives have leaned much farther right, thus making those who used to be moderate conservatives into liberals? Second, why is it that liberals are always faulted for being elite and not reaching out? It seems to me that it is the conservatives who have distanced themselves ideologically. Is this an example of liberals castigating themselves when really the conservatives are more at fault?
Those are great questions. With regard to the first one, about whether it's that the Republican Party is moving rightward and therefore people who used to think of themselves as moderates or conservatives are now identifying themselves as liberal, Paul Krugman has made this argument, I believe, among others. I will acknowledge, you know, in full disclosure, that it certainly applies to me. I was a registered Republican from the day I turned 18 to the day after Election Day this year, when after Trump won, I changed to an independent status because this isn't what I thought this isn't the party that I originally joined. That said, it should be pointed out that when you poll Americans about whether they identify as liberal, moderate, or conservative, there hasn't been all that much of a shift over the past 20 years. The shift is confined to the academy. And some of the better academic research suggests that, no, this is actually still a leftward tilt. With regard to whether or not liberals are being, you know, self-flagellating, that there's hostility to professional elites and so forth, and why not conservatives, I think this is the difference between left populism and right populism. There is clearly a left populism. We saw it with Bernie Sanders during the presidential race. Left populists tend to target billionaires or plutocrats as their ideal enemy. Right populists tended to target professionals, educated professionals. And you can argue that the difference is that right populists generally have to deal with professionals in a way that they don't have to deal with billionaires. So it's easy for the left to demonize, you know, rises, increases in economic inequality and point to the top 1% as the true boogeyman. But truthfully, right populists tend to actually value or see value in people who make a great deal of money. They tend to want to be those kinds of people. What they don't like are the people who constantly tell them what to do, whether it's their doctor who explains what their health insurance coverage will and will not control, whether it's a lawyer, whether it's a school administrator, what have you. That's the group that they tend to resent. And so, therefore, unfortunately, universities are now a prime target.
Hmm. Well, got some interesting times ahead, I guess. And I want to thank you so much for being with us. When is the book coming out? We'd love to interview you when it is released.
I'd be happy to. The book will be coming out in April.
Great. All right. We'll give you a ring.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Look forward to it.
Thank you. Thank you so much for being with us. Professor Daniel Dresner, professor in international politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. His most recent book, before the one that's coming out in April, is The System Worked, How the World Stopped Another Great Depression. And we thank him. He wrote a piece that caught our attention in which he agreed with a lot of what Nicholas Kristof wrote in his piece about the Academy needing to be reaching out to more conservatives to be on the faculty, but also more understanding of people who have conservative thought and not be thought of as being bigots and racists. And he also said what we need to look at is how unusual this past election was and take that into account. So he wrote his piece in the Washington Post. Thanks very much to Scotty Myers for producing the program, Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production. Reminder to send your greetings to KP Whaley, who leaves us tomorrow for North Carolina. We'll miss him.